Thank you very much. We are here to bring you the story behind the music you love and to introduce you to the men who make that music at Orchestra Hall. You'll also get to hear an informal and easy-to-understand discussion of music and its interesting personalities. And what's more, you, listening right now, have an opportunity to win two main floor tickets to a concert by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And now let's open your symphony scrapbook to the page devoted to the soprano of the string section, the violin. And we have with us to discuss and demonstrate this instrument, Mr. Morris Monitz, member of the violin section of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Monitz, I'm sure our listeners would like to have you identify the selection you played at the beginning of this
program. No, I haven't. This is simply a bowing exercise that I personally use every day to help me in my orchestra work. And being a second fiddle player, and our right hand is more important than our left, because the first fiddle players really have the job of playing on top of the violin, but our most important thing is to play with our bow.
I think with that background, it would be interesting to hear some more of that exercise. Rather interesting to have you open the program with a practice exercise, because usually we have some work from the standard repertoire, and that gives me an opportunity to ask this question that I think the general public is always interested in. How much do you, as a member of the violin section of a major symphony orchestra, have to practice? Now, you have, say, four rehearsals during the course of the week, three, sometimes four concerts during a week's engagement. Now, do you have to put in any other time beside that in keeping your fingers supple?
Well, I have a very funny history with myself, Mr. Kuiper. I think I can truthfully say that I've played more auditions in the violin section than probably anybody else since I've been with the Chicago Symphony, and partly I was asked to play, and partly I wanted to do it myself, and so I personally have practiced more than anybody else. Now, I don't know if it shows in my playing, but I have practiced more, and I don't do anything else beside the orchestra. But there are ways of getting away in the orchestra without practicing too much. I mean, especially when you play second violin. You don't have to practice so much. But I personally did, because I say I played a lot of auditions, and I had to practice a lot.
But now another question. You said something about being a second violinist. You find that your right hand is more important than your left. I think that will puzzle some of our listeners. Would you explain that?
Well, in the second violin literature, and especially in a major orchestra, the bowing is very, very intricate and difficult. And if you don't practice a lot of bow exercises at home, you'll have a real tough time in the section. And there's certain numbers and certain overtures that when I came to Chicago Symphony from out-of-town orchestras that I had to do, I was really puzzled until I took them home on the bowing and practiced it. They were very difficult.
Now, the bowing marks are, of course, set by the conductor, because seldom are they in the score itself, set by the composer. Who has charge of transferring them to the different parts? The leader of the section?
The concertmaster, usually of an orchestra, is the boss of the bowings, unless the conductor happens to be a violinist. And he does it. But if he's not a violinist, he really tells the concertmaster, and usually the concertmaster puts it down. But the conductor usually tells the concertmaster. I mean, he's a real boss, and he tells him what to do.
That's mainly referring to up bow and down bow. And
yes, and slurring, and the way he wants it, either at the frog, and at the middle or the tip. Some conductors, I had a funny incident when I joined the civic orchestra. I used to play certain things in the middle of the bow, and I don't want to mention any conductor's name, but the conductor at that time said, oh, no, you cannot play that at the middle. You must play that at the frog. And that was his opinion. I mean, you had to play
but
it at the frog.
There is a school of conductors, isn't there, that believes, or is Tchaikovsky the only one, who believe in, I believe it's called free bowing?
Well, Mr. Tchaikovsky, or Stokey, as the boys call him in the orchestra, started that, and I think Mr. Ormandy, when he was with us, also used a lot of free bowing, and that's really the Russian style. They claim that's really schmaltzes up the music. I mean, and it's true. I mean, certain things that they do, it gives for a very fine tone.
It gives you more freedom.
Yes, and it sounds better. I mean, to the layman especially. I mean, that's real show business, but it sounds.
Although I don't believe the layman enjoys watching it so much, because he's. I think the average layman gets worried that the bows are not all going up at the same time or all going down at the same time.
That's true, but in Ravinia Park, Mr. Kuiper, it's not true. I mean, they'd rather listen to fine music, and it should really sound good instead of bowings. I mean, it's not that important, except the orchestra hall, sure.
Well, of course, we naturally want to add orchestra hall as well as Ravinia. Well, now, I wonder if you could illustrate the difference between the first violin, a first violin part and a second violin part.
Well,
would it be possible?
Yes, Mr. Kuiper. I have here the Moldo, written by Smetana, and I'm going to play the second fiddle part first, and then after that I'll play a small part of the first fiddle part, if the first fiddle players in our orchestra will forgive me.
Now, while that is going on in the second violins, this is what is going on in the first violins?
Yes.
The second violins are adding a sort of embroidery to the melody which the first are carrying. But frequently the second violins also carry the melody, don't they?
That's true, but when we carry it, we carry an octave lower than the first violins do. And we always, that's the most difficult thing to play second violin. You have to fit in. And that fitting in sometimes drives you crazy, especially if you played first fiddle a long time. But when I first took the position here as second violinist, I never played second before, and it was the funniest thing to get used to, but now I don't think I could play first anymore. I mean, you just have to fit in. It's very difficult, and the first fiddle players think, well, second fiddle player don't mean anything, but it takes it's quite a trick to be a good second fiddle player.
Well, there was a song in a Fritz Kreisler operetta, Apple Blossoms, that he wrote, oh, I guess about 20 or 30 years ago, titled We Can't All Be First Violins. And I think you have brought out an important point, that the second violins are pretty important in a symphonic composition. Oh, here's a question I'd like to ask you. You've had experience, I judge from some of the things you've said, with a number of conductors. Now, as a member of the violin section is playing a symphony during a concert, the conductor is up there waving the stick and beating time. How much of the conductor's beating of time does the average member of the orchestra, let's say violinist, see? I ran across a statement some time ago, it just comes to mind, that a member of the orchestra has to watch not only the conductor's beat, but also his face. I think that's the way it went, to get the expression of his face. Now, how much of that beat do you see as you're playing in the line? You're looking at your music. How much of the beat do you see?
Well, you should watch the beat. I mean, of course, a major orchestra like the Chicago Symphony, a lot of times the men don't have to watch the beat. They're very wonderful orchestral players.
Well, there's a feeling of communion between...
That's right. They have wonderful experience, but...
But say when you have a new conductor, a guest conductor you haven't played with before.
Well, sometimes the beat is very hard to follow. And if you're not a very good orchestra player, you can get lost. I'm not mentioning any names, but it's very difficult sometimes to follow the beat of certain conductors.
Well, of course, that's
others
the famous story of the musician who asked another musician what the conductor programmed or played last night, and they said, well, or what he conducted, and they said he didn't know what he conducted, but we played the such and such symphony. I imagine that happens once in a while. But to get back to the question, as you're looking over your music, do you see this beat?
Yes, we have to watch his beat, and it's very important to watch his beat. And but as I say, some conductors have a very fine beat, and some haven't. And it's easier to play with a conductor who has a fine beat. Otherwise, you never get lost. And sometimes we've been pretty confused.
He's always there, ready to.
Yes, a fine conductor has a wonderful beat, and you really have to follow it. But sometimes something happens and.
The implication is that as a symphony musician, you do depend on the conductor.
Absolutely. I mean, you're supposed to. But certain things happen that sometimes you don't.
He does conduct you along the ways of music.
That's correct.
Well, thanks ever so much, Mr. Monitz, for this interesting program that you've given us. And now we're very happy to send a pair of tickets to a concert by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra to Miss Helen Kozlowski of Chicago. For her anecdote, which we're adding to our scrapbook, she writes, "One often hears about Maestro Toscanini's temper, but this little anecdote reveals another aspect of his personality. Many years ago, a certain Italian conductor was asked to donate his services for a festival of Verdi opera in Italy. When it came to signing the contract, he insisted on a large sum, even though the festival was for charity. But after the contract was signed, he learned that Arturo Toscanini was to appear as one of his fellow conductors. And on hearing this, he promptly tore up his contract, and the larger fee that he insisted upon was no longer satisfactory. 'I will appear,' was his ultimatum, 'on one condition. I must be paid a higher fee than Toscanini.' 'Well, how much more than Toscanini do you want?' asked the manager. 'You may pay me 1 lira more than he,' was the prompt reply, 'but I must get that larger fee.' When it was over, imagine his surprise when he got a check for 1 lira. Toscanini had contributed his services."